For the week of December 2nd, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 172, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And outside of MoMA with a bunch of quarters, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ah, I see. So you must be referring to the fact that MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, it's probably one of the world's most well-known or well-respected museums. They have decided that they are going to add video games to their collection.
That's right. I guess it's an idea of video games as design and aesthetic, as opposed to, you know, the gaming experience. They're sort of celebrating the design element of games and how influential they've been.
Right. They've added, and I thought of you when I read this. I thought, wow, I wonder if Michael's going to go and see this exhibit. I mean, there's 14 different games that they're adding, and they're going to be in the Philip Johnson Gallery. I mean, I don't necessarily know. If I had known all those years ago that my Atari cartridges could be worth money, I would have saved them.
Well, I've got the quarters in hand right now, so I'm ready. I'm ready to line up. I'm not sure if we'll get to play, but I'll be ready. They don't seem to have the games that I was addicted to. I played Space Invaders and Asteroids, and then I cut the cord and walked away before I, you know, took over my life. So they seem to have a lot of ones that came after them, like Pac-Man and Myst and SimCity 2000. But, you know, it'll be an interesting exhibit. It'll be interesting to see how they do it, how they present them. How blown up are they? What does it look like in that context? So it'll be fun. Worth checking out.
Or is it just like the Pac-Man video game, like in a corner?
No, I'm sure it won't be that. But I don't know. I don't know exactly how they're doing it. So I'll be intrigued to see.
And who are they buying them from? Like, well, who do you buy this
from?
Well,
they have to get the rights to show them and display them. And so it would depend who owns the rights, whether it's the original creator or somebody. And the way they display them also impacts, I imagine, what they'd have to pay for. So it's an interesting question about how you acquire a video game and what context. Obviously, if it was a archival museum where you had like the original console or something like that, you could just buy it. So I'm not sure in this way what the deal is. But some people are complaining there weren't enough Japanese video games because they're wildly influential. There were not nearly as many of them. It seemed a little U.S. oriented. But we'll have to see how the display and the collection develops.
Well, I wonder, you know, Pac-Man, I don't know if Pac-Man's around anymore. So I wonder who's...
Of course it is.
Well, no, I mean, I wonder who's in charge of his estate. Is it Mrs. Pac-Man?
Very good. Little Pac Jr.
Oh, that's right. I think they did have Pac Jr., didn't they?
But your Atari cassettes are worth something because for a friend's bachelor party before his wedding, we bought him a classic Atari console with about 20 or 30 classic cartridges to play games that he grew up with. And he loved it. I think he was more excited about that than the wedding.
Or the bachelor party.
Oh, yes.
Well, now that, you know, you say you're in New York, but based on the clanking of quarters behind you a moment ago, I'm pretty sure that you're actually in Atlantic City. So I hope you'll be able to join us and be pulled away from the slot machines long enough to tell us about some of the week's big news. And on today's show, we will be talking about the start of the awards season because, well, frankly, it's December and we've held off as long as humanly possible. But there were a few awards ceremonies over the last week, one in New York and in Europe. And we'll tell you which movies were picking up trophies. In television news, Fox believes that television has to change in order to capture consumers. I think it needs to change into a video game. We, and by we, I mean Michael, he's going to be telling us all about what the heck Fox thinks about TV. Then there's yes, you are. And maybe you can even tell us about Jeff Zucker. Remember, he was the former head of Universal or NBC Universal. Well, he was summarily dismissed once Comcast took over NBC Universal. But now he's been hired by CNN. He's going to be heading up CNN. The year is also wrapping up on Broadway, and we've got some news there. In fact, we'll even be mentioning Spider-Man. Turn off the dark. I love doing that, by the way. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the weekend after Thanksgiving here in North America is always a downslide because everybody went to the movies over the Thanksgiving holidays. But this year, it's been strong in North America, and it continues to be strong around the world. So the number one movie around the world is The Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2. It grossed another $66 million. It just passed the $700 million mark worldwide. That's pretty much where every other film in the series ended up, the last three, I should say, in the series. So we'll have to see how much farther beyond that this can go. It is the finale, so people who haven't tuned in before might go see just the final movie to see it all wrapped up, or fans who don't want to say goodbye might go two or three more times than usual. We'll have to check it out.
Well, I can say we should mention that it's $66 million worldwide, not just here in North America.
Yes, I said that.
Just wanted to reiterate it.
Thank you. Number two around the world is Rise of the Guardians, the animated film that is struggling a bit to find an audience. It grossed $53 million worldwide. It's at $105 million and counting, but don't count it out because it is a holiday-themed film, and the studio thinks strongly that this will have good legs and be able to do business down the road. Number three around the world is the James Bond film Skyfall. It continues to rewrite the James Bond record books. Another $51 million worldwide. It's at $870 million and counting. $1 billion is probably out of the question, but not completely.
And not by much. I mean, certainly, look, hey, $870 million. I'm sure Sony and MGM aren't crying. Let's put it that way.
Certainly not. But that's still, that's an amazing figure, and I'm not quite sure what territories, if any, are left. So the possibility of $1 billion is, you know, a little murky. Number four around the world is Life of Pi, the Ang Lee film, which is an Oscar hopeful.
It's an Ang Lee film that's based on a best-selling novel.
Yes.
Yes.
It grossed $33 million worldwide. It's at $109 million and counting. At number five is Lincoln, the Steven Spielberg film, which has essentially opened only in North America and was one of the winners just a few minutes ago at the New York Film Critics Circle. It grossed $13.5 million, and it's at $83 million worldwide and counting. At number six is another animated film, Wreck-It Ralph, which grossed $9 million. It's at $200 million worldwide and counting. At number seven, the big flop of the week, this is a Brad Pitt film directed by the man behind The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, one of my favorite films of the 2000s, the entire decade. It was a terrific movie. They had a troubled time together, kind of like Kevin Costner and Kevin Reynolds had on repeated films like Robin Hood and Waterworld. They got back together on this movie. Brad Pitt's company made it for a dime. It only cost $15 million to make. It's based on a really fun crime novel from the 70s, great dialogue, and the movie was a complete flop. It opened to $7 million, and bizarrely, it got an F from fans who went to see the movie on CinemaScore. CinemaScore is this, as far as I'm concerned, essentially useless thing where they ask people after they saw a movie, what'd you think of it? And if people hate a movie, they give it a B. I mean, it's like every movie gets an A or an A minus or a B plus. If you really didn't do well, you get a B or a B minus. Killing Them Softly got an F.
Yeah.
I don't remember the last time a movie got an F. Everyone who saw this movie hated it. So that's really...
Well, that wasn't the response in Cannes where the film premiered, but...
It got poor reviews. It got mixed reviews in Cannes.
Yeah, no. It was not good by any stretch of the imagination. I remember thinking at the time, the only thing I liked about this movie, other than maybe the way some of it was shot, was effectively... I don't want to say...
When it ended?
Yeah, pretty much. The last line of the movie, because I often use that line with clients.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't spoil anything, you know, but you can't say it anyway. You'd be cursing. Yes, no, the film had a political overlay. The book was written in the 70s, and they set the book during the election campaign of Barack Obama in 2008.
Yes.
And that's sort of the political backdrop, the financial collapse, the corruption in the financial world, and Obama running for president. It sort of creates a certain backdrop for the film. A pointless overlay. It didn't work, but it did result in one good line. At number eight is Red Dawn, the reboot of the earlier film about an invasion of the U.S. It grossed $6.5 million, and it's at $31 million worldwide and counting. At number nine, the Oscar hopeful Argo, directed by Ben Affleck, it grossed $6 million. It's at $157 million worldwide and counting, and it broke the $100 million mark domestically, so that's a good sign for that film. At number 10 is Flight, the Robert Zemeckis film, and it grossed $4.5 million worldwide. It's at $81 million in counting. And at number 11, Hotel Transylvania, the animated film, it grossed $3.5 million, and it's just under $300 million worldwide and counting. But for me, the exciting news of the week, or I should say the anticipated news of the week, was the world debut of The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, in New Zealand. 100,000 people. If not 140,000, I forget what the latest estimate was. Tons of people showed up to watch the red carpet. 100,000 people came out to watch the stars walk the red carpet and go in and see the film. That's unbelievable.
Especially since some of the stars are so tiny. I mean, you can barely...
Very, very good. Very good.
Because they're hobbits. You see, they're hobbits. Yes, and they're elves. They're entire... Okay.
Elves are not tiny.
I know.
So, not in this world. So, it opened there, and I thought we would get a deluge of reviews. I mean, there were fans inside that movie theater. It was not all industry people. I believe there were fans inside. And then it has screened in Japan. So people in Japan have seen the film. It was an industry type thing, but there were fans at that screening in Japan. Now, I know critics have seen it because they had to in order to consider it for end of the year awards. I know people who saw it last Friday. It's been screening all over the place, New York and LA and elsewhere. So critics have seen it, and they've been asked to hold their reviews until December 5th. That's 9 days before the world debut on December 14th. That's not terribly unusual. Some people have tried to read into it and say, oh, it's going to get terrible reviews, and they're trying to hide the bad press. I'm like, no. They usually don't want reviews to run until, you know, a week at the most before a movie opens. That's natural. But all those people saw that movie in New Zealand. All those people saw that movie in Japan. They're not industry people. I can't find a single online review of this movie.
Well, first of all, you've got the people in New Zealand are all cast and crew, so they're not about to break any embargo.
Surely there's some fans got into it.
Possibly, but I'm sure that they have been told, and that, you know, you don't just walk into those screenings at times.
But no, I know, but that's what astonishes me, the fact that nobody has broken the embargo, not one fan, not one, and my point is that Peter Jackson has co-opted the sites that would have done this. Ain't It Cool News? They obviously would have done that immediately. The One Ring, which is this online fantasy website devoted to Tolkien, they would have wanted to run something like that, but they can't because they want their access to Peter Jackson and the film and all the news. They don't want to anger him. They don't want to tick him off. And the people who normally would have run with this stuff immediately don't want to. So even if they got a review, even if they got some information on the film, they've made the decision to honor the embargo and wait till December 5th. And so I think it shows smarts on his part for, you know, co-opting them and getting them in on the game and invested in keeping a good relationship with him in the movie and therefore not wanting to break the embargo. I think it's unbelievable. I can't remember the last time a movie was screened this widely and you couldn't find casual reviews online.
Well, you know, this goes way back, more than a decade.
My God, that's forever.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, but I mean, for the internet, in 2001, I went to the Cannes Film Festival. I'm sure you were there as well. And there was a little shindig for Lord of the Rings, the very first.
A little. It was huge. I couldn't get into it.
It was so big. And I, at the time, internet journalists were... Well, the bastard stepchildren of what they considered real journalists were, which were television and print. And so I was having an ongoing running argument / debate with the publicist at New Line, who said I was only given five entries from the U.S. For online journalists. And guess what? They flew over from Austin, Texas to Cannes, France.
Barry Knowles, I remember sitting next to him when they screened a trailer about 15 minutes of footage.
20 minutes of footage, yeah, and I was sitting probably right behind you because he was sitting in front of me. And so, yes, he was flown over, the person from the One Ring, the Tolkien website that you just mentioned, they were all flown over on New Line's dime to go to this party and to see this 20 minutes worth of footage. The film was only coming out later in the year. So
yeah, it was like 7 months away.
Yeah, so it wasn't, it was just the first time. So this has been going on. This co-option, as you call it, has been, this dates way back. The roots of this date all the way back to 2001.
Yeah, so that's, they know that's a combination of the growing importance of the internet and the fact that they didn't want these fanboy websites to spoil the fun. And so they let him in on the game in order to keep their clamp down on the information. I think a smart move on their part.
Yes, but it's not as if back then, at least, Harry Knowles was saying, thanks to New Line Cinema who flew me over. You know, they didn't make that known. I guess now they would have to.
There'd be no legal obligation right now. They should.
I thought the FCC said that you would have to mention that.
That how that would apply to him is very vague. It's not very clear right now.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's put it this way. I look at The Hobbit right now, and maybe it's because it's the first in what will be three films, because, you know, generally when you adapt a book, you try to turn one book into three films. I look at that as, well, it's not being mentioned by any of these year-end award shows or film critic circle picks.
Well, they've just started. It could certainly be on the National Film Board list or Golden Globes. I mean, who knows?
True, but I mean, okay, that's true. But
we've only had the New York Film Critics. I mean, you know, it wasn't likely that the Gotham Awards were going to honor, you know, The Hobbit. That's an indie award, isn't it?
Yeah, wait, yeah, The Hobbit isn't an indie film?
No. So the Gotham Awards came out. They honored Moonrise Kingdom, that won Best Feature. That was the big winner there. And past winners included The Tree of Life, Winter's Bone, and The Hurt Locker. So, of course, those are all independent films, essentially.
And they all went on to get a Best Picture nod for the Academy Awards.
Right. That's a very short track record, so we'll have to see.
Right.
In comparison, the European Film Awards just came out. The big winner there was Amour, the film by director Michael Haneke, which I saw last week. It's terrific. Easily one of the best films of the year. By far his most emotional and warm films. I mean, this is a cold, austere director, but this movie is delightful. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. It won the European Film Awards. And it just won Best Foreign Film from the New York Film Critics Circle. And they are the third group to start to name things, you know, to come forward. Yeah. To make their picks for the best film of the year. They named Zero Dark Thirty, the hunt for Osama bin Laden film. That won Best Picture and Director for Catherine Bigelow. And a little surprise move, Rachel Weisz won for Best Actress in The Deep Blue Sea, a very good film that came out back in February from Terrence Davies. And Daniel Day-Lewis won Best Actor for Lincoln. And again, the Amour won Best Foreign Film from them. And Best First Feature was a little-known film, a documentary called How to Survive a Plague, which also was a winner at the Gotham Awards. So read with it what you will. It's the beginning of the awards season. Every week, something new will come up, and we can all say, oh, it's up, it's down, it's been snubbed, it's got momentum. We'll have to see how it goes from here.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the European Film Awards, Haneke won Best Director. As you mentioned, they won Best European Film. And Jean-Louis Trintignant, and he won Best Actor for Amour. And Emmanuel,
and he was very much in the running for the New York Film Critics Circle. I think a lot of the ballots were tight this year. And from what I hear, he was right in the mix with Daniel Day-Lewis. There were no walks in any category this year. Nobody dominated. So I think if that's true, and that continues when we see LA Film Critics and Golden Globes and the National Film Board, if all these things seem spread out, I think it's another year where we'll see a lot of nominees. Again, if there's one or two really big dominant films that everyone thinks is the best of the year, like, say, Les Mis, then that will suck up a lot of the votes, and therefore you'll only have five movies getting enough votes to, you know, be a Best Picture nominee. But when it's spread out, that's when you end up with 7, 8, or 9, or even 10 nominations.
And that's at the Academy Awards, but I'm talking...
That's the only one that matters.
Well, yeah, in fact, I loved what German comedian Anke Engelke? How do you pronounce it? Anke Engelke. I don't know. It's a comedian, a German comedian.
She's hilarious.
Yes. She kicked off the evening of the European Film Awards by saying, by comparing them, she said, this is the 25th European Awards, or as they are known in America, the what?
Actually, she's kind of funny.
Yeah. Well,
I frankly barely heard of them. I mean, I've heard of the BAFTA Awards in the UK and, the Cannes Film Festival, but I'm not terribly familiar with the European Film Awards or their good track record.
Well, they've been around for 25 years. Winning Best Actress this year, also Amour, Emmanuel Riva. So those two, I mean, and they were fantastic in that film.
I was hoping they would get a nomination. I was hoping rather they got a win from the New York Film Critics. Rachel Weisz was sort of left field. It's a shame one of them didn't win. He seems to be getting more of the awards momentum than Emmanuel Riva, but she has, I think, the flashier role. It's a terrific performance, both of them. And I hope it does get momentum and is nominated for Best Picture, not just Best Foreign Film, and they get nominated for acting because they both, you know, richly deserve it.
You know, I keep hearing from different pundits that Daniel Day-Lewis is a lock for Best Actor.
I don't think so at all.
And because of, you know, Lincoln, obviously. I don't know. I do know that you like the little girl whose name I will not try and pronounce. I was going to try and pronounce it, but no, I'm not going to try and pronounce it. Ben Zeitlin's film, Beasts of the Southern Wild, which won a couple of awards at the Gotham Awards, which is effectively the Spirit Awards, but for the East Coast. This is one Sundance has gone on to appear in Cannes and continues to rack up lots of buzz during the awards season.
She would have been 11. She could get an Oscar nomination for a performance she gave at 11 years old. So that would be kind of fun.
Yes. And, How to Survive a Plague won Best Documentary, so that seems to be also capturing quite a bit of buzz. And so, but ultimately, this is all leading up to, as you say, the Oscars.
Right. And of course, this year, you don't even have to be an Oscar voter to get on the show. You could just be a guy who wants to be on the Oscars. You could just be a film school student.
Yeah, well, so Seth MacFarlane and the producers of this year's Oscar, which are Craig Zaden and Neil Marin, they have decided to turn to the future of what could be the Academy and the Oscars, and they are doing this nationwide hunt for college students to present Oscar statuettes during the February 24th ceremony. Now, I would imagine that this is only going to be one or two different categories. It's not going to be, you know,
oh, it'll be one, or it'll be like a documentary short.
Right. Or like best short film or best documentary short. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know what they're trying to do here, whether they're just trying to create buzz and get a lot of publicity by having
buzz.
People talk about it. Like, I don't know, us.
I think it's just a nice gesture that the stars of tomorrow come from the film schools of today.
Oh, okay. Well, then.
You know. What else? It's not to push ratings, for God's sakes. No one's going to tune in to see some college student.
No? You don't think the whole town of, you know,
no.
Yeah, okay. Well, then maybe not.
Yeah. Well, that's the future of the Oscars. And of course, that's always a big event on television.
That's right. Now, I wonder what the future of television is.
Well, Kevin Reilly had something to say about it, didn't he?
Well, who is Kevin Reilly? First, let's explain who he is. He's a man named Kevin with a last name of Reilly.
Oh, and there he is. He's the head of Fox.
Yeah, okay. That might be the more important little factoid there.
Why don't you read it off, and then I'll give my opinion on what they mean.
Oh, okay. Well, Kevin Reilly, the head of Fox, he knows that the ways people watch TV have radically changed. Well, he thinks for good, and that the studios have not remotely caught up to the ways people have changed their viewing habits. Or as he puts it, and this is a quote, "We have our head up our ass," end
that
quote.
That can't be good.
Yeah, no, I think it's pretty dark, actually. Both figuratively and literally. You know, in a wide-ranging discussion at a Hollywood Reporter luncheon, Reilly went through a checklist of virtually every facet of the television business. Now, the first bullet point here is launching all your shows at the same time, he thinks, is a stupid idea. And stupid, that is with a capital S.
Well, he's swimming against the tide a little bit here. People have been saying for a while, why do we release all our shows at the same time in the fall? But then they started releasing shows in the spring and some in summer and some here and some there. They've been splitting up shows a little bit, do 8 episodes now and then another 8 episodes in 3 months. And I think people have come back around to the idea that, yes, you don't want to launch every single show of the year all at the same time. But the fall television season is a chance to get everybody to focus on television, to break through the clutter of the news and get people to pay attention to your new season. So there is value in that. As well as, you know, spacing out your schedule all year long. You can release a show in March or June or August, but it's a little hard to get attention for every single show. So there's value in breaking away from the pack and doing it off on your own. There's also value in that launch pad of the new fall season. So I don't think you have to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but he has a point. You know, he says if they'd launched Glee in the fall, he says it probably would have been canceled quickly. But because they launched it when they did off season, they gained traction, they gained attention, and they had a noteworthy hit for the last 4 years.
Well, what I would tell Kevin Reilly is why, you know, he works at Fox. Why not, you know, walk across the lot to his brethren over at 20th Century Fox and he can ask, well, these days he wouldn't even have to walk across the lot. He'd just have to, you know, take the elevator down to another floor in the building. And he could ask them what it's like to try and launch a film every week. It's very difficult when you have them spread out. However, when is it not difficult? During the summer, when everybody's paying attention, during the award season, when everybody's paying attention.
Well, on the other hand, studios did used to ignore January and February and August and all these months of the year where they wouldn't bother to program anything but junk, if anything at all. And now they know that they can make money 12 months a year. People want to go to the movies in February. They want to go in January. So there is no reason not to release quality films all year long. Doesn't mean it is a lot harder. So yeah, it's going to be hard, but there's advantages to it as well. You don't leave money on the table.
Well, the second bullet point here is he says the upfronts, which are, you know, when networks show pilots and convince advertisers to place ads on their shows, you know, he says that they are stupid with a capital S.
That's right. There's a quote in this article because a lot of other people were chiming in. Catherine Pope is the president of television at Chernin Entertainment, and she complained about the quote, falseness of the upfront and the fall launch that bites you in the ass every time. A lot of focus on the ass in this article because, end quote, because it forces the producers to rush to finish in time to make an air date. So she's bitter about having a deadline. Every show has a deadline. It doesn't matter what happens, whether you release it in the fall or the spring, or you got to get it ready for the upfronts to show it to advertisers. But they all think the idea that every show has to be ready at the exact same minute so advertisers can see it and then decide whether they want to put their ads on it 6 months before anybody in the world has noticed the show, you know, it seems a little crazy to them. Seems a little backwards. And I have to agree that, again, it helps to get all the advertisers in the room. It helps to make your case for the next year and what you've got planned, you know, and to show them what's in progress. You know, don't create any false, you know, deadline for yourself. If it's coming out in January, don't try and get more done in August just to sort of have something to show.
Well, you know, industry traditions are around for a reason.
Uh-huh.
So,
and you think upfronts make sense, or do you think?
Well, I think that's the way that people have been buying television ad time for quite some, you know,
decades.
Yeah,
but people
now
have also, they've also set the ad rates by going for 3 months of the year. February, May, and November.
I'm not
right?
saying those traditions have to change. I'm saying that.
Well, that's what he's saying. We want to know, should the tradition change? I think the idea that you set your rates based on 8-12 weeks of programming is stupid. I think your rates should be based on
Is that stupid with a capital S or a lowercase s?
It's a capital S.
Okay.
And maybe even italicized.
Ooh, okay.
Right. So I do think there's a lot of things that could change. If you do change how you set your rates, then you will also change the need for upfronts. If you're constantly updating your ratings, so rather than saying just based on the November sweeps, you base it on what it's actually doing week by week, and you just constantly keep upgrading or updating your information as far as how well that show is doing and how well the time slot is doing, and therefore what you can charge for it, that to me makes a lot more sense than saying waiting till November and seeing how it does for a four-week period.
Now, the next bullet point here from Kevin Riley of Fox, he says, doing cheapo programming during the summer is, get this, you won't believe what he calls it, it's stupid with a capital S.
What's his quote?
He says, quote, I see us in the industry buying cut-rate fare because we think people want to watch cut-rate fare in summer. That's not true. End quote.
Well, I think he's absolutely right about that. There's no reason why you can't launch quality television in the summer, though you have to remember this, you know, it's people stay out later. They don't get home till 9 o'clock rather than 7 o'clock. So typically you see in the summer that viewing is very depressed in the 8 p.m. hour. The question is that because you're showing reruns and junk, or is it because people are out later because it's sunnier and it's nicer out? So, you know, there are some reasons, like you say, there are long-term reasons why some of these things are the way they are. People go out and spend more time outdoors in the summer. That's just natural, depending on where you live. But when there's nothing on TV and it's all reruns, of course nobody watches. On the other hand, summer has been a great field for experimentation. Fox, of course, has their biggest hit period in all of TV history, arguably, is American Idol. And that launched as cheapo cut-rate fare in the summer.
What year was that?
That was, well, it was 10, 11, 12 years ago.
Right. So, you know, maybe 10, 11, 12 years ago that people were looking for cheap programming in the summer. And maybe what he's saying is now they're not. They've kind of progressed from American Idol.
Well, and long before that, Northern Exposure was a terrific show. That was launched during the summer. There have been other shows launched during the summer. There's no reason, again, why you can't program television, you know, 52 weeks a year, except for the fact that TV is really expensive. It costs a lot of money. They used to make all their money on reruns, and people zip through the ads. So people want more programming, and they want to watch fewer ads while they do it. It's kind of a conundrum.
That's like the entire entertainment industry, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, Northern Exposure, you're going back 22 years.
Well, there you go.
On that one. Okay, well, his next bullet point here, I think you'll agree with this, Michael. He says, Kevin Riley says, the way networks measure rating success is, and get this, with a capital S, stupid.
That's right. We got another quote from Catherine Pope, who chimed in on this, and she said, we are addicted to the ratings. We say it means nothing, but it still does. It's not just the DVR. It's all the other platforms and how people are consuming content. We haven't shifted our definition of success from the overnight ratings, and I think that's a huge problem across the board. And we've talked about this a lot on the show. I can't believe that the winner of the November sweeps is based on the live rating plus same day. They don't even count you if you watch it the next morning or the next afternoon or the next night. I think that's bizarre. Yeah, I mean, I can understand how they want to track how many ads people watch and what they zip through and not tell their advertisers. But as far as ratings are concerned, all I care about is the final total. So the idea that they haven't adjusted to this is crazy.
Well, his final bullet point here, is that shooting a pilot, that's not so stupid, with a lowercase s, by the way. He says others disagree about even this.
That's right. There's a quote from Peter Benedict. He's a co-founder of the UTA Talent Agency. And he said that pilots are difficult and whatever. But he says, quote, the creative people that he works with think there is, quote, nothing worse than making pilots.
Oh, it's horrible. It's a horrible process.
And he compares it to the way the British create shows. Peter Benedict says writers and producers should be able to develop multiple hours of a show and in some cases make 10 hours off a read. That means they just come up with like a script. People read it and they go, great, green light the show, and you just start to make it rather than having to film a pilot.
Well, but can I just say that, yes, okay, fine, do it the way that television is created in the UK. Now, with that in mind, I'm going to take your $10 million budget, which is probably what that would cost for 10 hours of television. I'm going to bring it down to, let's say, 500,000.
40 pounds.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's everybody that's from the UK that then comes to Hollywood or Los Angeles and New York and makes television here says it's remarkable how much money is thrown at the production.
So Peter Benedict and a lot of his people agree that making pilots is annoying and frustrating and insulting. They hate it. They don't want to have to film a pilot. They just want to make their show. True. Kevin Riley says there's a lot to be gained from the pilot process. You learn a lot of things while making a pilot. You can recast. You can spot problems. It's a very important step to find chemistry and all that stuff before you greenlight a show. There's obviously, you got someone with a track record, you're going to be willing to greenlight them. If they don't have a track record or you're not sure about the stars, you may want to make a pilot. There's no single answer to this other than the fact that always doing things the same way is not a good idea. And you can see that CBS is already acting on a lot of the things Kevin Riley's talking about.
Yeah, I don't think that Kevin Riley will be getting a job at CBS anytime soon.
No, they should, because they're doing some of the things he's talking about.
Well, no, I mean, but he says, pilots aren't so stupid, and then they go and they...
Well, but he also said you need to program in the summer, you need to have big shows, you can't just rely on cut-rate fare. And CBS has greenlit a series called Under the Dome. It's gone straight to series, no pilot, apparently. It's going to air on CBS in the summer. It's based on the Stephen King novel, Under the Dome.
Oh, that little fact. Yeah, the Stephen King novel. Okay, so there's a built-in audience.
It's, well, if everybody who bought the novel watched the show, you wouldn't have a hit.
Well, true.
Yeah, it obviously helps. But they've greenlit a 13-episode first season. It's an adaptation of the novel. They're not shooting a pilot. They're going to schedule it during the summer. So, and that also joins Unforgettable, which is a CBS cop drama that films in my neighborhood, rather annoyingly. And that's going to be airing next summer. So they're putting in some quality major programming in the summer. Other networks have been doing this as well. But this is, throw out the rule book. You've got Stephen King. You've got people you believe in. Do you need to shoot a pilot? Get it going. Get it out there.
Here's my question. We now know what Kevin Riley thinks about all this. But what does Jeff Zucker think about the future of television?
Well, what does he care? Because no matter what he does, he keeps getting hired.
That's true.
Goes to NBC and has a terrible time, though he would argue he did well with the cable channels. And then he moves up to NBC Universal. He has a terrible time there. Now he's gone from there, and now he's been hired by CNN.
That's true. Well, but where did he begin his career? Right out of, I think it was Harvard that he came out of. At the age of 26, he was put in charge of the Today Show in the early 90s, and they went on a 16-year run as the number one morning talk show. Not entirely because of him, but he was the producer that kind of helped turn it around, at least initially.
Absolutely.
And then, as you say, he kind of worked his way up at NBC, and then NBC Universal was the head of it and made some interesting decisions with Jay Leno and Fear Factor, I suppose, is another show that we could blame him for.
That was a hit.
I know, but I'd still like to blame him for it. But then, now he kind of, once Comcast bought NBC Universal, they said, hey, Jeff, listen, do you have a minute? Can you come in here for a second? Close the door behind you. And the next thing you know, he's pretty much out on the street. And he's doing the Katie Couric daytime talk show. He's producing that, which he will now leave in mid-January to head up CNN.
All of it. CNN International, the whole shebang.
Yeah, which... I don't necessarily know that this is a bad move. This sounds like an interesting move. CNN has to do something. And maybe getting Jeff Zucker, somebody who has been known to turn something around, a difficult situation in television programming, he's turned it around before. Can he do it across an entire network rather than just one or two shows? I guess this is his chance to prove it.
Well, the New York Times is a little snarky about it when they reported this. They like talked about him falling upwards or something like that, you know, because of his lack of success by some metrics at NBC and then NBC Universal. But if you want to capitalize on his biggest success, the area he was at the most is the Today Show, and CNN makes a perfect fit for that. I mean, that's his world. That's where he shines. And the Today Show, frankly, as they expanded into Saturday and Sunday and more hours and more hours, you know, they were on 3-4 hours a day, 7 days a week.
I know.
So it's not that much of a stretch to say, well, do it 24 hours a day, Jeff.
26 hours of television, and I was watching exactly none of it.
Well, I'm not up at that time of day, but he was very successful. And when you look at CNN and what they need to do, I think the Today Show or that morning show model makes a lot of sense. Do you want to be partisan right wing? Do you want to be partisan left wing like Fox and MSNBC? Do you want to have talking heads 24 hours a day? People don't tune in unless there's breaking news at CNN. And in fact, they found out during the election and Hurricane Sandy, they weren't even winning then. Even when there was breaking news, which used to be the one time people turned into CNN, they were getting beat by Fox and others, even on election night, even on nights where CNN should be able to succeed, if only at that time of the year. So they're in deep, deep trouble. And I think, you know what? The Today Show is a great model. You got personalities. You got people there mixing hard news and soft news. You can handle breaking news with aplomb. And you've got a core of people who are there for 3-4 hours at a time that have a sense of chemistry and camaraderie and can bounce back and forth from serious stuff to soft stuff. And you're intelligent, you're thoughtful, and you're entertaining, but you're not geared towards like this political point of view or that political point of view. People don't tune into the Good Morning America or the Today Show, which are wildly profitable, in order to hear a political point of view. They want news, unbiased, straightforward, entertainingly done. And as he says, there's a lot more to news than, you know, politics and war. You know, there are other things to talk about in the world. And in fact, there aren't a lot of problems with CNN in a way. It's huge all over the world. It has $600 million in profit last year from its channels and websites, which is a record year. It's its most profitable year in history.
It's a huge brand. I mean, everybody recognizes it.
They've done a great job with their websites. They've done a great job around the world. The only area they're floundering, and it's a big one, is, you know, the U.S. and essentially prime time. So if you've got a lot of problems and you need to fix something, I'd love to go to a company where you're having a record year in profitability, and therefore you've got a lot of money to spend and do what you need to do. Now, Katie Couric is doing well. She's the most successful new launch of a talk show this year. She's not huge numbers. She's not Judge Judy or Oprah in her heyday, not even close. But she's doing well, and Zucker's walking away from a big payday, you know, that he would have gotten if he'd stuck with the show. So, you know, he's going to keep some of that money, but he did successfully launch her. But he's going to CNN, and frankly, if she gets bored with the daytime talk show, if she wants 2 or 3 hours on CNN, believe me, the door is wide open.
Well, that's true. I mean, she and Jeff Zucker are fast friends, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's television. I know that we also have some news in the theater world. Broadway is coming. The Broadway season is coming to a close, or at least the year is, as it is for, by the way, everybody. But there's some kind of capping of the year, if you will.
Well, you're making a distinction that you should. The Broadway season runs from May to April. So we're in the middle of the new Broadway season. It began in April of 2012 or May of 2012. It will end next April. That's when the Broadway season runs. And so we're getting final figures from the last Broadway season, which is from roughly mid-2011 to mid-2012. They got to tote up all the numbers. It takes them a while, apparently. But last season...
A while. It takes them more than half the year.
Well, same. You'll see in music a little bit down further. Fours, you know, charts their musical season from mid-year to mid-year as well. You got to wait for quarterly profits and quarterly itemized numbers. You got to wait for all those figures to come out officially before you can comment on them. So the Broadway League came out with their info last season, which ended in mid-2012. They sold 12.3 million tickets, which is down a little bit from the year before. They grossed $1.14 billion on Broadway. That's a record amount. That does not include off-Broadway or touring, but it's a record amount for on-Broadway, $1.1 billion in gross profits. You know, how'd they do it? They, you know, higher ticket prices. Not as many tickets sold, but they charge more for them.
Wait a second. Let me get this straight. They didn't sell as many tickets during the last Broadway season, the last year of Broadway, but they raised ticket prices and earned more money. Where else do they do this in the entertainment industry?
Hello, Hollywood.
That's
it's not
right.
It's not a good formula long term, trust me. Visitors from overseas are a huge factor on Broadway. They bought almost one out of every five tickets sold.
Well, when you look at the exchange rate, one can understand that. I mean, right now, if you're from Europe and you're coming to the U.S., it's kind of like a bargain. Same with some of the Asian countries. So, of course, you've got a lot of tourists in New York. When the exchange rates even out, like they did in the late 90s, that's not always the case.
Well, they might drop a little bit, but tourists are always a big part of Broadway from overseas. I mean, visitors come from all over the country as
that's
well.
Right.
But overseas in particular, they said, is what we sold one out of five tickets. So I would imagine that would go down if the economy heated up a lot and became a little more expensive. But when people come to New York, they want to see a Broadway show. And the new hits that joined the long runners like Wicked and Jersey Boys and The Lion King, the big new hits in the past season were The Book of Mormon, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, Once, and Newsies. Here's one I didn't know about, though. Women make up 67% of the Broadway audience.
Well, I guess they're not taking dates, or if they are.
They're going with friends. I know a lot of women who go with friends, but I'm a little surprised by how much they dominate. That's a lot. Wow, 67%. You can see why Wicked is one of the biggest hits of all time.
Well, and, what are they going to see? Well, apparently, the big theater goers, hardcore theater goers, saw more than 15 shows were accounted for 5% of the audience.
Right. 5% of the audience went to a ton of shows. It's like going to a movie every week, practically. So
right.
5% of the total audience accounted for 29% of total admissions. So those people who live in the area and go all the time to a Broadway show, every other week, practically, they're a big part of this. Big part of the theater world. 30% of total admissions, one third generated by 5% of your audience. That's kind of amazing.
Well, isn't there like some figure, and I'd have to look this up, that 40% of box office grosses comes from heavy moviegoers?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure you're right.
I'm going to look that, and now you've got me curious. I'm going to go look it up. Maybe not right now, maybe after we're done, but I'll look it up.
So, those are the big hits on Broadway right now, but that we can be expecting in 2014 and beyond to be seeing more shows like King Kong.
Yeah, I love this story. It's the team behind Broadway's musical. I just love saying this. Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. It makes me sound like a trailer guy. Anyway, they might have wondered a while back, who those guys were that were recently walking around backstage at the Foxwoods Theater. They were taking a look around and kind of kicking the tires a bit. Well, it turns out it was the team behind the theatrical extravaganza, King Kong, as you just mentioned, Michael. And that opens, that big musical extravaganza opens in Melbourne, Australia in 2013. And the producers are thinking of hitting Broadway in 2014. Guess what? Foxwoods, the home of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, is the biggest theater and the most advanced technologically. But, the producers of Spider-Man, they're saying like, hold on a second. Hold on. We're not going anywhere. And ticket sales are great. Well, kind of. And the owners of the house say they weren't necessarily looking to book King Kong and expect, Spidey and Spider-Man, to be warbling away for years to come. And by warbling, I really mean warbling. The producers of King Kong, they say they weren't trying to edge out Spider-Man. They weren't talking to, they're talking basically to lots of Broadway theater owners. And isn't it nice that all these theater owners are interested in their big giant show, King Kong? Now, the 800-pound gorilla in the room here, other than King Kong, guess what? It's called profitability, which none of these shows seem to have. Spider-Man has bounced up and down, but remains in the black week to week. One of the producers wouldn't discuss how much of the $75 million budget has been earned back yet, but says he thinks the show will have to run, another 5 to 7 years for the show to earn a profit, which... In Broadway terms, would make you about...
The idea that he could lively say, after the show has been open for 2 years, well, we'll have to run for another 5 or 7 years to get a profit. He just tosses in an extra 2 years. 2 years makes you a big Broadway hit. You run for 2 years, that's a massive hit. And he's saying after 2 years, we'll have to run for 7 to 9 years just to break even on Broadway. That's astonishing.
Yeah,
and we can see, if you look at the current grosses for Broadway, Spidey did great. Thanksgiving week, all the shows had big audiences Thanksgiving week. They'll all have big audiences Christmas and New Year's. But the week after Thanksgiving, Spider-Man dropped from 1.7 million to just over 1 million. And we believe its operating budget is 1 million. So it barely broke even this week. It may have even lost a little money. We don't know. But it's, it's not having a good run. It's starting to fade a bit.
Well, I saw a headline earlier this week that was about another show that's not having a good week. It's called Silence, the Musical. And this was the headline that I read, and I thought, well, duh. It's called Silence, the Musical, to close. That was the headline in the New York Times, and I thought, well, of course. It's called Silence the Musical, and since there's no music because it's silent, of course it's closing.
It's the worst idea for a musical ever.
Yeah.
It's actually a spoof musical. It started out on the web as a online YouTube sensation. It's a musical spoof of Silence of the Lambs. What if they made a musical version of Silence of the Lambs? And the two guys who did it, they came up with two or three songs. They got tons of hits, millions of hits, and it became a fringe festival event here in New York City. And then it moved to Off-Broadway. I saw it. I did not like it. And the thing ran and ran and ran. It ran for 18 months. It played in three different houses. It kept moving. It just wouldn't die. It was like a zombie more than a serial killer. And it's finally announced it's closing. More power to them. You know, I don't wish them ill. And the lead actor originally in the show was quite good. And the woman playing Clarice Starling was funny, too. But the songs just weren't good enough for me. But anyway, it ran for 18 months. It still hasn't made back its money.
And now it's playing in Los Angeles.
Oh, well, I'm not surprised. It's not good. I don't recommend it. But 18-month run in New York, and it couldn't make back its money. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that. A lot of times, they only played 4 to 6 shows a week.
Big problem. They had
a big cast with 12 actors. They had a band. They had to move theaters twice. So that all adds money. So that, it doesn't make it easy. But there's another show off Broadway called Tribes, an excellent show. If it does come to Los Angeles, you should see it. It's about a son, a deaf son with hearing parents, a terrific drama. It got tremendous reviews. It ran for 11 months. It's closing in January. And they very proudly said, we've just recouped our money. We haven't lost a penny. You know, we just made our money back. We've got like 6 weeks to go, and they're finally in the black. So, I mean, it's very hard to make money off Broadway. You have to go to Broadway if you want to make bucks.
And so, but as for Silence, the musical closing, I shouldn't go see it with a glass of Chianti and some fava beans.
No, it is a big whoop of a musical.
Ooh, okay. So then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Adele. In an era of deeply depressed album sales, UK artist Adele has surpassed a major milestone. She has sold more than 10 million copies of her album 21 in the US alone, and selling more than 10 million albums is known as the diamond level. You know, there's gold, there's platinum. Well, she now has a diamond record, not a gold record or platinum record. That's rare territory for any album, much less an album released in the last few years. Adele is joining acts like the Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, Linkin Park, Usher, and others to make the grade in the past decade. Worldwide, the album has sold, get this, 25 million copies and counting. On the other hand, her terrific James Bond single, Skyfall, only made it to number 8 when it should have hit number 1, in my opinion. So is going diamond a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. It proves it can still be done. Gives us all hope. Carrie Underwood is struggling to go gold with her new album, and she was one of the biggest acts of the past decade. So it's, you know, Rihanna finally hit number 1 this week. She has a new album at number 1, plus a new single, Diamonds, is also at number 1. So, you know, there are still big acts selling albums, but it ain't easy. And selling 10 million, that's always notable, no matter what era you're in. So it's nice to see it can still be done. You can still have a big, broad-based hit. So, you know, Adele's there, and we've got other people. Rihanna's at number 1. Taylor Swift is at number 2. She's obviously a big seller. And One Direction, the UK boy band, following in the wake of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, they were at number 1 last week with their second album. So they're at number 3 now. So, hey, people are still paying attention to music a little bit.
Well, now, since you mentioned Carrie Underwood, I'm going to skip ahead in our show notes here and talk about Carrie Underwood, because the hills are alive with the sound of music, y'all. That's the reaction of some of the news that Carrie Underwood, the American Idol superstar, she's going to be playing Maria Von Trapp in a live TV event next holiday season on NBC. I believe this is called sacrilegious. Anyway, it's I'm kidding. It's going to be overseen by Craig Zaden and Neil Marin when they're not doing the Academy Awards. The specialists in TV, movie, and stage musical adaptations, that's who those guys are. The production of The Sound of Music will air around Thanksgiving or Christmas live on NBC with Underwood singing about her favorite things, you know, kittens' whiskers and brown paper packages and, well, lonely goat herds and so on. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, actress or singer gets job. But I think it's a good choice. Like you say, Craig Zaden and Neil Moran are working on the Oscars. Now they're doing this. They've got a long history. It shows the power of American Idol. It's been the one source of big acts in the past decade here in the U.S., the one source for selling a lot of copies of albums. You know, she's been announced to be Maria. I think it's a good choice. I don't know how she can act, but she can certainly sing. I think she'll do a good job. And she doesn't have a country voice like Reba McEntire, where it might seem off-putting. She can fit smoothly, I think, into the role of Maria Von Trapp. How she'll perform it as an actress, I don't know. But you look at the charts this week, Phillip Phillips, who won the American Idol last season, his new album just debuted in the top 10. He also has a top 10 single. Kelly Clarkson is in the top 15 with her new greatest hits collection, her first one. And there's Carrie Underwood, I think, right behind Kelly Clarkson with her new album. You know, she's struggling to make album sales, but she's still a big star. And it shows, again, the impact of American Idol.
Hey, Michael, remember when we discussed how the Copyright Act was going to upend the music business, with artists suddenly able to reclaim all those rights to their albums after about 35 years?
I do.
Well, now it's coming to books. Termination rights, as they are known, are about to come into play for books published in 1978, and major authors like Stephen King, Judy Blume, Herman Woke, Ken Follett, James Michener, and Jean Le Carré, or their estates, and some of them aren't alive anymore, they are ready to pounce. The Copyright Act was passed in 1978, and so this is the first time books will come into play after 35 years have passed. Authors have tried to reclaim their books before, but this law makes it easier for them to do so, and digital distribution makes it a lot easier for an author to simply put out the books themselves or shop it around. Backlist titles, the backbone of the industry, by the way, they just became a lot more portable and, thanks to ebooks, arguably more profitable for the author. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's definitely a big deal. Be fascinating to see what happens. And I think the idea that, you know, authors can reclaim these books and just put them out themselves, which is something that simply wouldn't have been possible before. They would have shopped it around. They would have said, all right, we got the rights to our books back. Who wants to be my, you know, publisher? Who wants to, you know, pay me to have these books on their backlist? Well, now they might just say, yeah, I think I'll do it myself. They don't even need to bother with hardcover or paperback. Or they'll keep the digital rights themselves and sell it on their website and let hardcover and paperback be handled by some publisher who gets the dregs. You know, they get to deal with the complicated stuff, physical copies, shipping them to stores, doing all that. Whereas the author just posts it on Amazon and their own website and they're done.
That's right.
But what really struck me here, what really astonished me, was the list of authors who had hits back in 1978 on the bestseller list. This article linked to a list from 1978 for a random week. And it's Stephen King, Judy Blume, Ken Follett. They're all still on the charts. I mean, that's 35 years ago, and you still see these people writing bestsellers today.
Success begets success.
It's sure, but 35 years later, I mean, you know, you can have big acts 35 years ago. You're not going to see, you're not going to see.
Oh, you're going to bite your tongue on this one, or you're going to.
Well,
will
I almost
come
said Olivia
Newton-John.
I don't know why, but I remembered she and John Travolta have a new Christmas album out. So I was going to say Debbie Boone. That's what I was trying to think of. You know, Debbie Boone doesn't have a new hit album out today, even though she did in the 70s. So, you know, that's a long thing to do. But in books, I guess it's a lot easier to have a long, long career. And you're right. The best way to have a bestseller is to have one before.
Well, speaking of bestsellers, a lot of critics think the sitcom 2.5 Men is trash, but they wouldn't call it the work of Satan. So I guess it's not a bestseller necessarily, it's a hit show. But in any case, it takes co-star Angus T. Jones to call it Satan. The 19-year-old actor who plays Jake, the half in 2.5 Men, although I think now that he's 19 and of legal age, I think maybe it should be called 3 Men, but that's me. Well, he has found religion and feels trapped on the series, which he describes as, this is his words, not mine, filth. In a video witnessing on a religious website he filmed in his trailer at work, Jones said, quote, "Do some research on the effects of television in your brain, and I promise you, you'll have a decision to make when it comes to television, and especially with what you watch." He continued, "A lot of people don't like to think about how deceptive the enemy is. He's been doing this for a lot longer than any of us have been around." Jones said, presumably referring to Satan. That's the enemy he's referring to. And to continue the quote, he says, "There's no playing around when it comes to eternity." And that ends the quote there. Jones also said he doesn't drink and is a virgin. And I say, TMI, my friend, but that he smoked pot and dropped acid and even charity work couldn't fill up the emptiness he felt. Poor 2.5 Men. First, Charlie Sheen goes to the devil, and now Angus finds God and begs people not to watch. Later, Jones apologized in a statement and said, gee, he certainly never meant anyone to think he was being disrespectful of the show and the people who work on it.
It's just the work of Satan.
Right. Charlie Sheen chimed in and said, "It's radically clear to him the show is cursed and that he is winning. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?"
It's a big whoop. I mean, he just re-signed with the show, so I guess he got Jesus like a week after that. Because, you know, he signed for a 10th season. He gets $300,000 per episode. And the LA Times had a poll saying, should he be recast? And I'm like, why would you replace him? Who would notice if the kid went off to college? You know, yeah, would they lose that many jokes?
No.
But it's a big one.
Yeah, I agree. The bigger deal, in my opinion, is you look at that video and it screams out that this kid seems brainwashed by, like, almost in a cult way. Now, I'm sure I don't want to get into religion or anything like that, but it just...
Well, you just did.
Well, there's something a little off about the way he's behaving and this guru that he's following.
Well, he's a nasty guy with sort of an anti-gay and nasty, you know, ideologically conservative to the far right religious perspective, the pastor that he's following. You know, he's anti-Obama, anti-Jay-Z, anti-gay, you name it. But I think his name is it Chris Hudson? Is that his name?
Something like Christopher Hudson. Yeah. Or something. Yeah.
But, you know, brainwashed is not the right word to use, I think. I've done some fact-checking on articles about cults, genuine cults. And generally, the idea of brainwashing doesn't really exist. You know, you can brainwash them and mentally control them from a distance, and they have to do, you know, people get stuck in a little thing, they love it, they follow it, they get excited about it. But brainwashing, it makes it sound like they're zombies under the control of someone else, and it's probably not accurate.
Well, and, you know, Charlie Sheen got a lot of flack for speaking out against the show, but at least he was asking people to watch. He was getting people to tune in. Angus Jones is out there saying, don't watch. It'll rot your brain.
and steal your soul.
That's true.
And he may be right.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's not a good show.
Well, now, we were just talking about how success begets success. Well, this next story is a prime example of that, in my opinion. Forbes came out with its list of the top grossing musical artists in the world. And guess what? It pays more to create the equipment you listen to music on rather than the music itself, because number one on that list is Dr. Dre, who hasn't put out an album or toured in ages, but he has created a best-selling line of headphones, which netted him $110 million. And actually, that's not true. He did do that one show at Coachella, where he brought back Tupac Shakur from the dead in a hologram and maybe earning $110 million.
That's not touring, though.
I know, but this was my way of telling a joke about $110 million and buying a hologram of Tupac. Anyway.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you for stepping on my punchline.
Sorry.
I'm kidding. Number two in this list is Roger Waters, who hasn't put out a new rock album in 20 years, but has been touring and netted $88 million. Number three is the young Elton John with $80 million, also via touring. He had a new album scheduled, and that is Elton John. It was going to come out in the fall, and he was, the most exciting album he'd recorded in years, is what he said. Then he pushed back the date again and again, saying that he was unhappy with some of the songs, like, you know, the ones
album he's done in years, but he wants to record some new songs.
Yeah. Everything between the first song and the last song, yeah, I don't like those. It's now set to come out in May. Get the message? The people making money in music are not doing it thanks to new music and album sales. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. We've known about this for years. It's not a surprise. There are newer acts on here. You have Take That, the reformed British boy band. You've got Taylor Swift and Justin Bieber. They're in the top 10, top 15. Lady Gaga, Katy Perry. God, I wish I'd written Fireworks. She must have made so much money off that single song, Fireworks. Oh, my God.
Just selling it to trailer editors so that they could put it in
exactly.
Advertisements for Adele. Movies.
So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of touring is where you make your money. So you've got classic acts like Bon Jovi and Paul McCartney, who are not selling a ton of new albums, but they are getting people to come out on them, come out on the road and see them again and again. That's where the money is in music. That's where it always was in the old days. That's where it is again.
And how does Sade make $33 million to come in 25th on this list?
Well, again, this list, just like the theater list, this list was done from mid-2011 to mid-2012. Sade was on tour throughout 2011. She had a live album or greatest hits album, but she was essentially touring for the first time in a while. So that was all her tour dates in the second half of 2011.
Ah, okay. Well, now I'm going to remember you said 35 years ago, Stephen King, Judy Blume, they were on the bestseller list. You know, 35, that's a long time ago. How come they're still on the, you know? Well, I bet you next year the Rolling Stones might make this list. because they are 50 years old as a band now, and they're playing a bunch of shows, not a whole lot, maybe, you know, 12 at the most, but they're probably netting quite a bit from that since each ticket costs $1,000.
Well, that's not true. There's a range of prices.
The VIP tickets cost $1,000. And let's face it, Michael.
Yeah, but the lowest price that we saw in the U.S. they played in Brooklyn was $850.
Well, and you and of course, being VIPs, we'd have to get those tickets.
That's right. $850. The surcharge, the ticketing charge, according to a friend of mine, was $75. That's more than you should pay for a full ticket. And the surcharge was $75, to which he said, just charge me more and don't insult me.
That's like buying an airline ticket where they're like, oh, did you want landing gear with that?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I wouldn't go see anyone for $850. I'm sure they were fine. They're the Stones. They're a good live act. They still are. They can play Start Me Up. They can play Satisfaction. But $850? No, thank you.
Well, you know, The Guardian, the UK paper, was reviewing the concerts over, I guess it's the O2 Arena is where they're playing.
They didn't have to pay.
Yeah, I bet you're right. And the critic from The Guardian said, look, you know, they're not hiding the fact that they're in this for the money. And The Telegraph's Neil McCormick thought that the concerts kind of lived up to that hefty price tag. He said, you know, when looking for the secret of the Stones, it is perhaps that they actually listen to each other while they play and almost lose themselves in it, while their brilliant frontman keeps it all together. Encores included a gospel-y, you can't always get what you want. Well, maybe sometimes, for the right price, you actually can.
For the right price?
For the right ticket price.
I always want is to see the Stones and not pay $850.
Right.
To be worth the money, they'd have to come sit in my lap and play every song that I asked for. Anyway.
In any case, do you know how the online ads you see are often targeted to your own interests and demographics, Michael?
Yes.
Well, that targeted advertising is coming to TV, at least in the UK, where satellite company BSkyB and cable operator Virgin Media will both be rolling out targeted advertising geared for your specific household. Oh, that's a little scary to me. For Sky, this applies only to ad breaks on the channels that it owns and controls, like Sky Movies and Sky Sports. So if you're watching a Tom Hanks movie on Sky Movies, for example, they might roll out an ad pushing the debut of Cloud Atlas, which might make you change channels. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I guess. It's just the latest stage in annoying advertising. Nobody likes advertising. They do it online all the time. There was an article about U.S. television and how cable companies imagined that in the near future, they would have tiny cameras in your home to see who was watching and then do the advertising based on who was there watching. I don't know how that's supposed to work. It sounds like, you know, 1984.
Yeah, but I was just going to say, you think you have a problem with Facebook privacy? Yeah. Put a camera in somebody's living room.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works, but it drives me nuts. I just hope they get good at it. I went online to buy a platform bed, just the frame, a platform for my mattress. And I went to a couple different sites, ended up buying a company in Pennsylvania that hand builds them themselves out of, you know, wood that's grown in a forest that they resupply all the time. Whatever. I bought a platform bed platform, a wooden thing. My God, every time I go online, doesn't matter where I'm at, the New York Times, and everywhere, I see ads for beds and mattresses. It's all I see for the past 6 months. It's driving me crazy.
Well, behavioral targeting, which is what that is, or BT as it is known, is not a new thing. And it's just easier. It's easier to do it online.
Oh, and
if they could get this done on television, it would be a huge achievement.
I don't know how effective it is, though. I bought a thing on Carol Burnett. I went online to a website selling Carol Burnett's DVDs because I wanted information. I see ads for Carol Burnett all the time. It's like, come on. Like, just because I bought peanut butter today does not mean I want to see ads for peanut butter for the next 6 months.
You can use the do not track thing for
I try, please. And then no sites work and you have to click on every site to make it load properly. It's a pain in the neck.
Well, you know, Amazon does that. Like when I go and I look up the next time you go, they're like, hey, would you like these? You know,
you love Civil War books. It's no, I just bought one.
And I just needed to know the name of the author, for Pete's sake. Well, speaking of big conglomerates, News Corp is being rocked by numerous changes all around the world, including some people stepping down after being passed over, others being named the heads of newly formed divisions, and still others headed to court on corruption charges, possibly even to jail. Amidst all this turmoil, News Corp announced it was folding, quote-unquote, The Daily. And I don't know why I said it, quote-unquote. They're folding that online newspaper, The Daily. It's the tablet-only newspaper that launched with a lot of hoopla as the future of journalism and shut down quietly without anyone much noticing or even, what's that word again? Oh, yeah, caring. Except, of course, for the people who were working on it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, it was never a force. It never reinvented journalism. What they forgot was that the new way of sending news to people didn't mean, oh my God, now everybody wants their news to have video and flashy this, that. It's like, no. Journalism is journalism, and you can adapt and add new tools and new things, but solid journalism is what people want. Just like music is music, whether you're getting it on 8-track or CD or MP3, you still need good music. And so starting up a national daily is always a challenge, always a struggle. So the simple fact that you could do it didn't mean it was going to be easy to establish yourself and break through. People went to the brands that they knew, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Wall Street Journal. You know, those name brands were already there providing good journalism. So the Daily was starting 10 steps back because they wanted to do it cheaper with fewer people without the rich history of stuff to draw on. They just thought, well, but we're tablet only. It'll be exciting.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know how tablet only means that the stories just come to you. That's not true, as you just pointed out.
Yeah.
So you're saying this is a big deal or a big whoop? I'm confused.
It's a big whoop. You know, it was not a force in journalism. It didn't matter that much. It never got traction. So who's surprised?
Okay. Nobody. Well, let me ask you this. Would you be surprised if I told you that China might surpass the United States as the world's largest movie market?
Not in the least.
Okay, well, that is actually our topic for Inside Baseball this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, we're talking about this story, I guess, Ernst & Young, is it? They published a report that said, it was called the Spotlight on China, and they said by 2020, China will move past the United States to claim the top spot as the world's top, you know, largest movie market, which I
say, there are 1.3 billion reasons why that is so.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, so let me get this straight. There's 300 million people in the United States, and there are 1.3 billion people in China. So yeah, no duh.
But when you've got hundreds of millions of people in China who live at subsistence levels, so the number of people who actually have access to a movie theater beyond, you know, a screen set up in a village, it's still quite impressive.
Right. I mean, basically, and
India isn't doing it yet either. They have they have two reasons. One, again, a lot of poverty like China. And two, they have a much more successful homegrown industry where they have a ton of product that they churn out all the time. So they have less demand for overseas product.
And that's what Ernst & Young is saying in this report. They're saying, look,
oh,
part of the problem with getting to, you know, by 2020 to becoming the world's largest movie market is that Chinese consumers are, you know, constantly changing their tastes, and that they have traditionally paid, let's see, what's a little bit less than nothing? Yeah, nothing for content. And there's a lot of pirated, copyrighted material out there and pirated content. So they're going to have to combat the piracy. They're going to have to combat, the shifting tastes for different types of content. And
but they're already the number two market in the world.
Yes, they have quickly surpassed Japan as the number two market in the world.
And I don't know why India isn't up there bigger.
Well, because of how much money they are charging for content. So it's not a lot of money. And I'm not saying this properly, but effectively, ticket prices are lower. That's the bottom line. And it's the same in certain parts of Latin America. Not anymore, because that's quickly changing. In any case, you know, you mentioned that there are certain groups that are really, they're surviving on a subsistence level. But when you think about it, what they're saying is that by 2020, and this is Ernst & Young again, a report from Ernst & Young, there will be 600 million Chinese living at middle-class levels.
That leaves about 800, 900 million people without.
Right now, they're saying the movie growth is 17%, and it will be 17%, or was 17% from 2010 to today, and will remain so until 2015. But
it's growing very fast.
Yes, and that growth was driven by 247 million middle-class residents.
And the question is, how quickly will they open their markets? How many more Hollywood films will they allow to be shown in the country? How often will companies have to pair up with Chinese companies just to get their movies there, like we saw with Iron Man 3? That's a co-production between the studio and a Chinese film company, just so they can make sure they get released there and get, you know, preferential treatment. So there's a lot of things that have to happen for this to become a healthy development.
Right. And in fact, I think what you'll see is, gee, a lot of movies are all of a sudden there's a scene in China. Whether naturally or not, they'll just, you know, have some form of connection to China.
I hear in the Sound of Music, the live production, when they go over the hills, they end up in Hong Kong rather than, you know, some other country. They just try to work that in there.
Yeah, but I mean, when you look at 600 million people will be in the middle class in 2020, that's more people than live in the United States by like a factor of 1.5 at least.
Yeah, it'll probably be true even then, even 10 years from now or 8 years.
True. Well, I mean, there are 600 million people, at least there will be in 2020, that will potentially be going to the movies. But I wonder how many of them wrote to us this week. Apparently none.
At least from China.
At least from China, yes. None of our Chinese listeners have written to us. That's what I'm trying to say. However, we do have a listener from Aaron, who is a longtime listener and, in fact, a former guest here on the show. And he wrote to us about episode 171. Michael, do you want to read this?
Sure. It says, "Hi, guys. I just listened to episode 171 of Showbiz Sandbox and heard you mention the newly discovered early Hitchcock film. I wanted to mention that I recently went to a lecture at NYU where Hitchcock scholar Charles Barr spoke about new discoveries in, quote unquote, early Hitchcock research. Barr wrote a book a few years back called English Hitchcock and has continued to research this area. It seems basically all of the films he worked on in this early period, from the early to the mid 1920s, have been lost. And now only a handful of still photos exist with almost no paper records, making those rediscovered reels very important. At the lecture, Barr showed very convincing evidence of how individual shots from some of those early films, for which there are stills, could have influenced Hitchcock in later films. He showed a powerful connection between two of these films, on which Hitch was a writer or art director, and shots from Blackmail from 1929 and Marnie from 1964. Because there is so little information about these early films, it's hard to make a direct and absolute connection to later works. However, Barr was very convincing in his circumstantial evidence. All this is to say that for those interested in Hitch, these early films, such as the rediscovered clip now available online, and the research that Barr has done could be a very insightful resource. Here's a YouTube clip from the BFI of Barr talking about some of these early works. All the best, Aaron." And we've included a link to that YouTube clip in our show notes.
I love that he says new discoveries in quote unquote early Hitch research. That almost like there's early Hitchcock research. I mean,
Hitch research into early Hitchcock.
Right. Okay. But like that's a whole like area of study.
Absolutely.
Well, now Aaron wrote to us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that's where you can send your correspondence, your feedback, your comments on the show. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Now, you can find that information as well as all the ways to follow us. We're on Twitter. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox. And we also have a Facebook page, which is Showbiz Sandbox. So you can like us on Facebook. You can find all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to subscribe to the show. You can do so on iTunes, Stitcher, the Zune Marketplace, if that's still around, and pretty much anywhere where they give podcasts away for free, in Downcast on the iPhone. We actually ask you to rate and review the show, and I will be reading off a list of names who have rated and reviewed the show on on iTunes during the next episode. So,
well, it sounds more like a threat. I'll be reading your names.
Okay, well, if you... Yeah, if you don't want me to read, I don't know. Now you've got me all confused. But in any case, links to all the stories that we discussed on today's show, ad nauseum, they're on our website too, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and that is where some of his writing for the Huffington Post and others can be found. Michael, where is that?
That is at michaelgiltz.com.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.